You're quite obviously not going to be voting in this election, but I wondered if this is the first time and whether this is a process that you reevaluate when you, I guess, every election, every 4 years it would be there.
Yeah, we have them every 4 years. To answer your question, I voted in all presidential elections in my adult life. However, given the 2000 election fiasco here in the United States, the corruption of which has been brilliantly reported and documented by BBC reporter Greg Palast, and given the plethora of scandals in and lawsuits against the electronic voting machine industry here in the U.S., I've decided that clean presidential elections in the U.S. no longer exist. If listeners would like to read more about that, Greg Palast, G-R-E-G-P-A-L-A-S-T, gregpalast.com, gives excellent reports and documentation on the 2000 election. And if you want to read more about the electronic voting situation, there's a wonderful website by Bev Harris, blackboxvoting.com, which documents so many of the questionable things that are happening with the electronic voting machine situation. Now, I haven't decided yet if I will vote in local elections. Locally, we've had some questionable events transpire with electronic voting, and in my state of New Mexico, no electronic machines produce paper ballots or paper receipts. And without paper receipts, machines can be easily manipulated. So I sometimes tell people that as a result of voting fraud, I may have already voted and not know it.
Did you vote in the 2000 elections? Or
yes, I did.
Because one of the reasons that you gave in your article for not voting is the fact that the two candidates are remarkably similar. And it seems to me that I recalled hearing that to a certain extent, perhaps a lesser extent, in the last election. Was that a consideration you made at the time? Or?
Well, in the last election, yes, I did consider that, but I was still pretty much in the place of anybody but Bush. And I did vote for Al Gore. I did not vote for Nader. Thought about it, but I voted for Gore. And I've really taken a different approach now in the last 3 years, to where, of course, I am not in the anybody but Bush camp.
No. Do you think that voting for a lesser evil is a valid thing to be doing? I mean,
well, at this point, I feel so strongly that. You know, some people some of the feedback that I got in the article was that I'm defeatist. About 75% of people agreed with me and liked what I said. Other people did call me a fatalist or defeatist. And I guess I choose to call myself a realist. And here's why. We have a lot of parallels right now in our current political situation in the U.S. With Germany in the 1950s and 1930s. And I'm not going to enumerate them here, but listeners can read Mike Rupert's article, The F Word, F as in Fascism, at his website, FromTheWilderness.com, in which he spells this out very clearly. The 2000 election and the corrupt electronic voting system are two of the red flags for me that indicate that we no longer live in a democracy. And I do believe that within the last 30 years or so, the electoral political process in the U.S. has been subsumed by corporations and corporate money, so that no candidate who doesn't toe the corporate line has a prayer of being nominated. Now, earlier in the campaign, I supported Dennis Kucinich for president, but he's not owned by corporate interests, and in fact, he vehemently opposes those interests. Besides that, he's short and thin and not, as they say, telegenic. He's a vegetarian and he has an old wife, so how could he possibly get elected? I'm only half joking there. No one who is not in bed with the corporations and that whole corporate political system in the U.S. can get nominated, let alone elected. So for me, it's much bigger than let's vote for the lesser of two evils. I guess I'm looking at a much larger picture.
Right. Why validate a system that, is it fair to say, it seems to be fair to say, that you think is flawed by nature?
Well, yes, I do. And I guess that leads me to another question. I don't want to jump in too fast to your question about reform.
Well, this is what I was about to ask next, so that's just fine.
Okay.
Do you think it's beyond that?
No. Here's what I think about reform. I don't feel that our current government is beyond reform, and this is the point I really wanted to get across to people who call me defeatist, and that is that reform will not happen. I really believe will not happen by electing the right president. Since a candidate who would make the changes needed cannot get nominated, let alone elected, how can voting for a president make a difference? In fact, playing the voting game, and it is a game, thanks to the corporate political system and Diebold, the largest manufacturer of electronic voting machines, playing that game only perpetuates, in my opinion, the illusion that we live in a democracy and that we have authentic choices. I'm not sure if reform prior to a worsening of events is really possible at this point. The 2000 election proved that we no longer have clean elections in the United States. We also have the USA Patriot Act here, which is now law in the U.S., which has shredded our Constitution and our civil liberties. We are an empire hell-bent on economic, military, and political domination of the world. And those horrific realities are not going to be changed by pushing rigged voting machine buttons for the lesser of two evils. I also believe that if there is to be reform, revision, purification, transformation of the U.S. government, it's going to have to come from the grassroots efforts of individuals and communities who demand accountability starting locally with their elected leaders in their communities. I'd like to introduce listeners to a very, very important website, Solari.com, S-O-L-A-R-I, Solari.com. This is the website of Catherine Austin Fitz. She was the managing director of a Wall Street investment banking firm, Dillon Reed & Company. She also raised in the 88 presidential election for Bush. She raised about $100,000. She got an appointment as Assistant Secretary of Housing and Urban Development under the first Bush administration, which was a great education for her because she came out of that experience as a major whistleblower and as a major witness to breathtaking government corruption in the United States. She has a fabulous blueprint for local action in one's community that directly confronts and helps cripple the power of corporate political systems at the local level. I'd like people to know a little bit about her approach, which is very different, and it's not the high profile. You see, we've been programmed by the media and the political system to believe that in order to make a difference, we have to take high profile action. For example, elect the right candidate. However, you know, we vote only every 2, 4, or 6 years here in the United States, and the other truth is that we vote every day with our money. We vote with our purchases. We have to decide, is it going to be Walmart or is it going to be a unionized supermarket like Albertsons or Safeway? Are we going to subscribe to and watch mainstream corporate media or alternative media? Will we use our credit cards and use the corrupt money system, which Mike Rupert and Catherine Austin Fitz and a number of other people have superbly documented as replete with international drug trafficking profits? Or are we going to make cash purchases and avoid debt like the plague because it's the principal underpinning of a corrupt economic system? That's the approach I choose.
This leads to my next point, which is on boycotting. Do you see how boycotts can sometimes be criticized as being undemocratic because as more people with more money get more votes? Do you understand that argument, or how would you respond to that?
Well, when I talk about boycotting, as I did in the article, and boycotting the system, I'm not only talking about boycotting the rigged election system. I'm also talking about boycotting mainstream media, boycotting the use of credit cards, and using all the ways we can vote with our money and time, because the electoral system is already undemocratic. It's a rigged game. And in my opinion, playing that game says, you know what, I know this is a corrupt and rigged game, but I'm going to play it because playing it makes me feel better. And if I buy out of that system, I'll feel too scared, too powerless, too betrayed. And I'll have to face the fact that I'm no longer living in a democracy and that maybe I'm living in a totalitarian state, and that's too frightening, so I'll vote to make myself feel better by telling myself that at least I did that.
Whereas you're better off with a situation where you're perhaps purchasing fair trade products or purchasing materials that are manufactured in union shops as opposed to a sweatshop.
Right, and being as informed as possible by really, really digesting alternative news, alternative websites, and not buying into the whole mainstream media that that we have here in the United States, and I'm sure you have in Canada as well.
Mm-hmm. It's depressing. The same people are really in charge in both countries, it's fair to say.
Yes, I think that's definitely fair to say.
Now, you wrote something that really jumped out at me because I hadn't heard anyone express this in the media or even the alternative media yet, which is that there's a chance that elections in the United States may not take place as planned this coming November.
Yes.
Could you tell us about why you think that?
Okay, I'll be glad to. There is now superbly documented, extremely compelling evidence that the United States government was complicit in the 9/11 attacks in 2001. I want to refer listeners to a fabulous Canadian website, globalresearch.ca, which is the website of Professor Michelle Chuzadovsky, who teaches economics at the University of Ottawa. Also the website of Mike Rupert, which I've mentioned, from thewilderness.com, and particularly Mike Rupert's extraordinary documentary lecture called The Truth and Lies of 9/11, which is available at his website. In addition, there is a new book now written by philosophy and religion professor David Griffin of Claremont College in Southern California. The new book is called The New Pearl Harbor, in which he's compiled and meticulously documented evidence of complicity. The so-called 9/11 Independent Commission here in the U.S. has all this evidence, and they've completely ignored it. My point is that last week the U.S. government and its mainstream media fed us a steady diet of warnings regarding impending and widespread terrorist attacks in the U.S. this summer or fall. And just as the attacks were, in my opinion, a perfect pretext for an endless war on terror by the imperial U.S. military, it's not inconceivable that a terrorist attack or attacks between now and the November election could preempt that election. Why? Because our Director of Homeland Security has told us that if there's another terrorist attack, the terror level code, the color code, will jump to red, the highest level of danger. And with a red alert, the United States will be under martial law with its constitution suspended. Our country will be locked down. And I believe that not if, but when the color code goes to red, it's very likely that a congressional vote or a presidential order could suspend the election. And you see, what I want people to understand, and this is one of the main points of my article, is that the U.S. government is being run as a criminal enterprise by people who came to power illegally and who never, ever in their lives have accomplished anything honestly. Listeners should read Kevin Phillips' book, American Dynasty, about the history of the Bush family. You can also read much more about that at www.tarpley.net. These folks are not about to leave the U.S. government by an election or any other way, and they're going to do whatever it takes to stay in power. I recently learned that we have documents now going into the White House indicating that Richard Nixon in 1972 had a contingency plan that if he lost the 1972 election, he was not going to turn over the government. The criminality of this administration compared with Richard Nixon is beyond the pale. I would refer your listeners also to one of your Canadian stations, Vision TV, and Barry Zweiker, who's Insight Media Analyst, has done a series called The Great Deception, in which he's documented complicity in the 9/11 attacks. And then there's a wonderful website called www.September11th. It's all one word, September11th, written out, .org. That's why I wonder And I hope I'm very wrong about this, but that's why I wonder if we're going to have an election here.
Well, is there a historical precedent in the U.S. for delaying elections in that way? Has that ever been done before, to your knowledge?
Not that I know of, but we have those contingency plans spelled out in the Federal Emergency Management Association. The document that created that organization, we call it FEMA here,
yeah.
Disaster Management. That has been mentioned in the FEMA creation of that document. So we don't have a precedent, no. But it is conceivable. I mean, I can certainly envision that kind of thing could happen.
Something you said reminded me of something else. That's in one of our other interviews. One of the interviewees suggested that elections are what keep us from slipping into a dictatorship. Is it fair to say that you think that your country is pretty much there already?
Again, I would refer folks to Mike Rupert's article, The F Word, at FromTheWilderness.com, and looking at some of the parallels between other countries and ours who've slipped into totalitarian conditions. Yes and no. I think in many ways we are there, and in other ways there's enough awareness among people who do look at alternative media and are asking questions.
And certainly we're still able to get away with having a conversation like this. So.
Exactly. And I'm still able to go into a classroom and say what I want to say, and I've got I'm teaching a class this summer where we're doing a critical thinking project on the 9/11 situation, and students are going out and researching a lot of these websites that they've never seen before and learning things they've never thought about in terms of the possibilities that there was complicity. So, you know, we can still do that. For how long, I don't know. If the USA Patriot Act is really, really enforced, when that act is really, really enforced, that is a blueprint for a totalitarian state, absolutely, unequivocally. And if that is really enforced, which it would be under a code red situation, I think there will be no question that we'll be living in a dictatorship.
Well, it's fair to say that certain measures that are spelled out by the Patriot Act have been more or less acted upon already. You know, for instance, you've got quite a few people detained at Guantanamo Bay.
Right.
And even in the United States, I believe that there are still people jailed without being charged since September 11th. But
yes. That's correct.
Now, in your article, you spoke of a drug pipeline that helped finance the campaigns of both major parties in the U.S. in the 2000 elections, which is something that I knew nothing about before you said it. So can you let us know about something about that?
I am referring to an article that was written back in 2002, I believe. Or no, it was actually posted in 2000 on the From the Wilderness website. It was written by Michael Rupert with a collaboration with Catherine Austin Fitz. Catherine Austin Fitz has also written, if people want to search for this, do a Google search, a wonderful series of articles called Narco Dollars for Dummies.
Okay.
In which she talks about the flow of illegal drug profits into the stock market in the U.S., and into various levels of our economic system. But this article written by Mike Rupert in 2000, the Democratic Party presidential drug pipeline, he talks here about connections of Charles Manatt, who was formerly the chairman of the Democratic Party, and Tony Coelho, who managed Al Gore's campaign, some of their connections with drug trafficking in the Dominican Republic, and it's quite a complicated little series of dot connecting, but I'll let people sort of go read that for themselves. I think it's important to understand in the whole picture here that is going on with the corruption of the United States government, we have to really go back and look at 50 years, really, almost since World War II, of the intelligence community in the United States being very heavily involved in drug trafficking, often relying on organized crime groups through the sale of heroin and whatnot to finance various operations. Of course, we had the Iran-Contra scandal here in the 80s, mm-hmm. in which Oliver North was really the big granddaddy of financing the Iran-Contra situation, the Contras in Central America with drug money profits. There's just a tremendous amount of documentation on that. Gary Webb has written a wonderful book called Dark Alliance, and his whole series of articles on that in the San Jose Mercury back in 1998, I believe it was, really kind of drew everybody's attention to that. Now, a lot of people say, well, that happened then, you know, and it's not happening any longer. I think if you look at what Catherine Austin Fitz is saying in her article on Narco Dollars for Dummies, you'll see a lot of evidence that it is still happening. And by the way, since we're speaking of Kerry and Bush, John Kerry was on the investigative committee that looked into this whole drug scandal as far as financing the Contras back in the 80s. I'm convinced that John Kerry has enough evidence in his back pocket that would put the Bush family and a lot of other folks behind bars forever. And he said nothing about that. And as a matter of fact, even mainstream news today, this is not on the subject of drugs, but even CNN today was talking about how much of an echo Kerry is in relation to Bush, and why doesn't he say something different, which I thought was interesting.
Well, it's fair to say that there are quite a few similarities, and I guess we could back up a little bit, and it seems fairly well established that the occupation of Iraq would remain unchanged under Kerry. There are certainly other similarities between them.
Absolutely. As I mentioned in the article, you know, every time he speaks, he seems to be calling for more troops in Iraq. He says that he wants to make a speech, I think it's going to be on Thursday, about strengthening the military. He did vote for the Patriot Act. He states that the cause of Israel must be the cause of America. He is very much opposed to Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, who I think is a bright and shining star in this hemisphere in terms of a democratically elected leader who's drawing a line in the sand and saying, you will not come down here and suck up our oil. Of course, the United States tried to get rid of him a couple of years ago in a coup, which lasted a couple of days. Kerry has no problem with the recently U.S.-backed coup in Haiti. He's fine with the militarization of space. He's got a long history of connection with Monsanto Corporation. His national security advisor would be Rand Beers, who's been very involved with the toxic defoliation programs under Monsanto in Colombia.
Mm-hmm.
Also, his economic director, which, and I find this particularly nightmarish, would be Robert Rubin, who was formerly with Goldman Sachs before he was the Secretary of Treasury under Clinton, who participated vigorously in the looting of Russia in the 80s to the tune of about $300 billion and has very strong connections with Citibank, which is a documented money laundering institution. So I'm not excited about some of the people around Kerry, much less excited about his policies.
So it's fair to say that though he might be in bed with different individual corporations, certainly many of the same, perhaps not as he wouldn't have his an administration quite as soaked in oil as the current one.
No, perhaps not. But you know, since you're speaking of oil, I want to bring that up as an issue. I said a moment ago, I'm not sure reform is possible unless things get much, much worse. And one of the things that I mean by that is we are looking at the end of the age of oil. We're looking at a peaking of oil that's already happened and is going to profoundly affect our planet as population exceeds supply, with an unwillingness to conserve, an unwillingness, really at this point it's too late to convert in time, you know, to alternative energy sources, in time to avert a crisis. And you know, I don't know what the world oil crisis is going to bring forth, nor the worldwide inflation that a lot of people are talking about.
Yeah, so far it seemed to have resulted in drastically increased gas prices.
Very much so, yeah. And I think that's the tip of the iceberg. I think it's going to get much worse. And so it may be that, you know, when I talk to, I don't know how it is up there, but when I talk with, you know, average Americans, you know, I can talk about 30 seconds and eyes begin to glaze over and people change the subject. They just don't want to hear about what's happening. We're so hypnotized here with media, which calls itself news, but it's actually entertainment and advertising disguised as news. And we have a very, very hypnotized population. So I think that some really nasty things might have to happen in order to get our attention.
In Australia, you may be already aware, voting is a mandatory act. What would you think of a reform like mandatory voting?
Well, I just have to ask the question again. Mandatory voting for whom? If somebody made me go to the polls right now, if I legally was bound to go to the polls, I would probably vote for some alternative candidate. And, you know, that might satisfy my country, but it wouldn't satisfy me because I haven't voted for a viable candidate. I haven't voted for a candidate who has any chance of winning.
The other reform that we hear a lot about up here, and I've heard Americans speak of it as well, is proportional representation. Do you think that's a step in the right direction?
Again, it's a matter of who gets to run for president. and who the connections of people in Congress. I tell people sometimes that there are maybe, I could almost count on one hand, or well, both hands, people in Congress in the United States that I trust, who I think are clean, who I think are not in bed with corporate interests, because for the most part, our representatives are. And that's what I think has to change, not proportions, but what are their interests, what are they representing, who are they representing, and are they being good stewards of our money? There's a whole other issue that Catherine Austin Fitz raises that, you know, we've got $2.3 trillion missing from the Pentagon. We've got $59 billion missing from the Department of Housing and Urban Development. And we've got a government that is incapable of auditing itself. And we have very, very questionable practices in terms of our budget, in terms of whether or not we have a black budget, whether or not things are actually going to the places that they're supposedly appropriated for. And this is what has to be looked into. And Catherine's contention is this has to be looked into at the local level, and I would agree with that, and make these guys accountable. You know, we pay them $150,000 a year to represent us, more or less, that amount of money. And, you know, they need to be telling us where the money is. Then they need to be accountable.
The next election, are you going to revisit the idea of whether or not to vote, or are you tending now towards rejecting the notion of voting completely?
Well, you mean the election of 2008?
Sure.
Yeah.
Assuming that one happens.
assuming we have an election in 2008, I don't know. I don't know how what the world is going to look like at that point. I don't know who's going to be running for president. I have no idea.
You'll reevaluate at the time.
I will. Yes.